From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with stories of high strangeness. And happy birthday to Joe from Massachusetts, from your sister, Rocky. Hope you have a great birthday, Joseph. Here's what's happening. The co-pilot of the German Wings flight that crashed into the French Alps, his name is Andreas Lubitz, appeared to want to destroy the plane, something we talked about last night. A prosecutor citing information from the black box voice recorder said the co-pilot was alone in the cockpit and he intentionally started a descent while the pilot was still locked out. He said there was absolute silence in the cockpit as the pilot tried desperately to re-enter to get in, but he couldn't. He was smashing on the door and everything else. Air traffic controllers made repeated attempts to contact the aircraft. No avail. Passengers could be heard on tape screaming just before the crash. Details are emerging of the German co-pilot's past. Very depressed person, although his apparent motives for causing this crash remains a mystery. Jim Sanders, of course, the downing of TWA flight 800. Jim, we talked of two scenarios last night, either the co-pilot had a heart attack and died, or that he tanked this plane on purpose, and looks like we were right on that.
Yes, it appears that way. The Times of London had a story come out about midnight their time, talking about his mental instability. He was having, at that moment, having a personal crisis, which would seem to make sense, and that Lufthansa knew it. Now, let's assume that the Times of London is a good paper and knows what it's talking about, then you do have a pilot who is very susceptible to recruitment. I'm not saying that's where it went, but that would be the next logical step in an investigation.
What a tragic story, James. I mean, for someone like me, I fly a lot. I can just only imagine what these poor passengers were going through once they realized something was wrong.
If he's having that much mental trouble, and he, according to the Times of London, he was suspended from training for mental problems.
Oh, and they bring him back.
And they brought him back.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Jim, thank you so much.
Okay.
Jim Sanders, tragic story there. And the co-pilot, of course, Andreas Lubitz, 28 years old, German national from the Rhineland. He had been blamed, of course, as the perpetrator for this horrible story, killing all 150 people aboard. They say he did not have terrorist ties. What would possess someone to do this? So we're going to check in with psychiatrist Dr. Peter Breggin about this. Peter, I know it's a little early to piece this together, but I've got to tell you, this guy put this plane on a slow descent. He sat back in his cockpit chair and just slowly cruised into the mountain. Who would do this?
Well, you know, it's very unusual, and we don't have the data yet, George. I'm going over the things that we that are similar to this. He may be partly a 9/11 copycat. If there is no religious or ideological drive, and it's personal, it looks like kind of like maybe he got the idea from 9/11, and that's always just such a terrible risk. Some of the cases I've been involved in that look a little like this, you know, the women who have driven their cars, you know, into ponds and rivers to try to kill their children. They've mostly been on psych drugs. We have the school and the workplace shootings, which are often involved with the individual killing himself or being shot by the police. And it has similarities to that, of course, and those involve a lot of planning. Most of those, George, involve psychiatric drugs again. And they often involve video games and other kinds of practicing violence. We just don't know. But one thing that is very striking is no one has brought up psych drugs. I've gone through the media. No one is raising the issue if he's depressed. He's been depressed. Is he on psychiatric drugs?
That's a good point.
If that's the case, it tells the whole story. I've just been involved in so many cases that have aspects of this in which psych drugs have driven somebody over the edge into this compulsively violent and self-destructive state.
Peter, thank you so much. And folks, do say a little prayer for the family of those people who died in this tragic crash. Oil jumped about 5% on Thursday as the biggest gain in a month as airstrikes in Yemen by Saudi Arabia and its Gulf state allies sparked fears that escalation of the Middle East battle could disrupt now world crude prices. Here we go there. Robots will use humans as pets once they achieve a subset of artificial intelligence known as superintelligence. That, according to SpaceX founder Elon Musk, who claims that when computers become smarter than people, they will treat us as pet Labradors. His comments were made in a recent interview with the scientist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who added that computers could choose to breed docile humans and eradicate the violent ones. That may not be a bad idea. NASA plans to launch a craft to capture a boulder from a nearby asteroid and move it into orbit around the Earth's moon for exploration by astronauts. And what else is going up in the skies? Let's check in with Peter Davenport on his weekly UFO update for us. What kind of reports are you getting, Peter?
Yeah, good evening, George. Well, I can delightfully report that the volume of reports has been down. At least the volume of telephone calls has been down for some strange reason. Typical number of calls for a typical day is somewhere between 20 and 40, and some days it's been down to 2. And when that happens, I get really suspicious. It inflames my normal paranoia. So I don't know what's going on, but we have a couple very interesting conferences coming up, and I think with your permission, I'd like to close with a brief description of those.
Sure.
But I've got 3 good reports that have come in recently that I think are very, very interesting. Last Sunday, the 22nd of March, a gentleman was in Lisbon, Portugal. He was taking a photograph of a nearby castle. As he took the camera down from his eye, he saw a cluster of lights, two clusters of lights up in the night sky, and he realized that he'd captured them on film, 2 clusters of green lights. Very, very interesting. The first question I asked him is whether he might have taken the photo through a plate glass window.
Good point.
And gotten a reflection of lights behind him. He was out of doors, though, and he said he saw it with his naked eye, which rules out the possibility of some kind of lens flare, which we see many of when people take a photograph of the sun or a bright light. But people can see his photograph on our website at ufocenter.com. Very interesting photo. Wednesday of this week, just yesterday, the 25th of March at 9 a.m., Sitka, Alaska, husband and wife were in their house with their 4-year-old son. They heard a very strange sound. They describe it as a sonar ping. And concomitant to that, their son started getting very agitated. He was looking out the window, and he apparently saw something very strange. He did a drawing of it. Now, bear in mind, this is a 4-year-old boy who did the drawing, but you can see the parents' report and the young son's drawing of what he said or what he saw. He told his parents that it was like a disc with a bulge on top and an antenna or 2 sticking out the top of it. Very interesting case.
Fascinating.
Just yesterday, last night, just 26 hours ago, a retired adult female was sitting with some of her children in her home in Washougal, Washington, just east of Vancouver, Washington, and Portland. The whole house started trembling. And under ordinary circumstances, the first thing I would suspect is something from this planet, an earthquake or maybe a helicopter, a military helicopter passing overhead. But it seemed to be getting worse and worse. They could see the windows bulging and vibrating. They opened a window to see if they could see the object, and it moved, they say, very slowly over the house and receded. They rushed outside to see if they could see something. They saw absolutely nothing, but the sound continued to the north and disappeared from their hearing. They never did see anything. Very mysterious case, and we're getting a lot of cases of very strange sounds. Back to conferences for a moment. A couple weeks from now, I'm going to be in Eureka Springs, Arkansas for the Ozark UFO Conference.
Great event, and of course, in memory of the late Dolores Cannon.
Absolutely. And looking forward to it tremendously. And in mid-May, the 16th of May, We're 14th through the 17th, actually. Yet another conference in McMinnville, Oregon, the McMinnville UFO Fest. So I hope people will consider coming to join us, and we'll talk to you next week, George.
You got it, Peter. Thanks so much for your work. Talking about UFOs, up next, we're going to talk about UFOs, I Know What I Saw. And what about a project called 701? James Fox joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, director James Fox with us this hour. He started his career early in life as an assistant to his father, a writer, Charles Fox, who had multiple sclerosis, by the way, was also a quadriplegic. He traveled with his father on many magazine assignments, interviewing people like Stephen Hawking, race car legend Dan Gurney for the likes of Rolling Stone. You did it all, but then you got involved in UFOs, Mr. Fox, and you can't stop, can you?
Well, you know, my father was so opposed when I told him I was going to do a UFO film, which quite honestly, I think that because I'm a Taurus, I think had he not been opposed to it, I probably would have never got it complete because I was so hell-bent on proving him wrong.
Well.
it kept me going, you know.
Speaking of films, now what's going on with your Project 701 with Tracy Torme?
I just spoke to Tracy. He says hello, by the way.
Okay, great.
About a half an hour ago. And Tracy has gotten the film because it's a feature documentary, so it's a hybrid. He's mapped out the entire film and storyboarded it. We're hoping to have the script and the additional research done. We've shot about 85% of the documentary portion of the film is totally complete. We're hoping to have the script complete by the end of this summer and then start shooting hopefully early next year for the feature part of the documentary. But one thing I wanted to mention, if I could, is during the process of some of my research, I was in the National Archives researching the Socorro case because that was a case that Tracy felt that was very significant.
Quickly tell us about it for those who don't know about the police officer.
It was Officer Lonnie Zamora. It was April 24th, 1964. There was a landing and occupant seen piloting whatever this object was.
An egg-shaped object, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was an egg-shaped object. There was a book written by Ray Stanford called Socorro Saucer in a Pentagon Pantry. Apparently, he's one of the only people who got it absolutely right, according to the Zamoras. That's what they told me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a phenomenal case. It's interesting, actually, when you go into the Blue Book files, I actually managed to get access to the original Blue Book files last year. You know, they've got diagrams of the footprints. They've got, you know, the scorch marks from the bush. They've got newspaper clippings from other eyewitness testimony. They've got all this credible information that substantiate his claims, the police officer's claims, that there were occupants. And he made eye contact with one of these occupants, and they scurried off around the craft and took off as soon as he approached. But the interesting thing is when you read the conclusions of Project Blue Book's, you know, conclusions on it, is that, yeah, there was a crash scene, but they never once mentioned the occupants, which I think is a pretty significant detail.
Yeah, that was the biggest part, I think.
But during my research, I came across a film titled that the Air Force was very concerned about. A film crew with Empire Studios came out in 1965 into the Socorro area and interviewed all the primary witnesses, including Lonnie Zamora, the Air Force was concerned about. I found out later in the archives at Lonnie's house, actually, I befriended his wife, Mary, and we became good friends. I spent 2 weeks with her, and I went through Lonnie's archives. And in those archives, I found newspaper clippings about a film called Phenomena 7.7 by a guy named Dr. Frank Stranges. I know he's kind of...
Know the name.
Yep, Dr. Frank Stranges and a guy named Michael Musto. But it's 40-minute shot on color, 16-millimeter footage, and 40 minutes of that film is dedicated to the Socorro, New Mexico case. I cannot find a copy of this film anywhere. I've been looking for it for over a year. So if any of you listeners out there, pretty pleased with Sugar on Top, if you've heard of it, Phenomena 7.7, it's interestingly enough based on the fact that in 1965 there were 5,000 roughly Blue Book cases, out of which 7.7% remained unexplained. Of course, we've got our film, which is 701, which is by 1969, the termination of Blue Book, there were 12,618 cases investigated, out of which 701 remained unexplained. So it's interesting parallels.
We might have access to this film, James, if you can believe it.
would give anything to get access to that film. It's the only film that I know of that documented the town, documented the landing site, interviewed all the witnesses, interviewed the mayor. It's shot on color, 16mm, good production values from Empire Studios.
Okay, check in with Tom because he has a source that might have this film.
I will definitely, definitely do that. Very gladly do that.
And then,
I'm kind of losing you a little bit here. Is that my phone or yours?
I can hear you well. You're coming in loud and clear.
Okay, good. So, yeah, we've been trying to get a hold of that, and I've looked everywhere. I actually went to a storage facility from his wife and spent probably about 3 or 4 days going through about 500 boxes looking for a possible...
This Zamora case that happened in 1964, when I first started hearing about it, I thought maybe what he was looking at was some kind of test of the Eagle lander that the astronauts used when they landed on the moon in 1969, because this happened in 64. Could have been. And I'm saying, and I'm thinking, okay, so the occupants that he's looking at from afar, he's probably seen astronauts in white uniforms and white outfits, their spacesuits. I wonder if that's it. I ruled that out eventually, James, but in the beginning, I thought that's what he was looking at. What do you think of that?
Well, when you go to the National Archives and you look through all the, you know, the Air Force wanted nothing more than to provide a prosaic explanation for this. The Air Force was panicking. They were, I have all these documents, they were saying, you know, there were inquiries coming in from the offices of the president, from members of Congress, from the media, you know, and the Air Force was putting tremendous pressure on Dr. Hynek and others investigating the case to come up with a prosaic explanation. And believe me, they wanted to. They would have done anything to do that. And they really downplayed the fact that he saw these, what Lonnie called small people, children. And if you look at the early newspaper clippings, which we also got access to, you'll see reports with it before the Air Force came down to put the clamps on the story. Because they really wanted him to downplay the fact that he saw occupants, they really managed to get these incredible descriptions of these occupants. You know, and why would they put children piloting, you know, super secret stealth aircraft at the time? But fascinating account. And the Air Force was unable to do that, but they tried. And who was that infamous debunker? Klaus.
Philip Klaus.
Did you ever interview him?
Yeah, I did a long time ago on my local St. Louis show.
Well, he wrote letters to. It's funny actually when you look at some of his public articles, but he actually wrote letters, which I have, to Lonnie Zamora, saying like, oh, you know, I don't want to like question your, you know, credibility or anything like this, but you know, I just thought that maybe you might consider just, you know, maybe possibly taking a look at one of these, you know. It was really diplomatic and really kind and trying to get his foot in the door, and Lonnie never responded to him, but he basically said, talking about some kind of plasma ball or something. It was absolutely ridiculous. So he was looking, they were all looking to come up with a prosaic explanation, and they just were unable to. And I didn't realize just how much there is to that case until I started digging into it. Because, again, like I said earlier, you know, Tracy really pushed me into reopening that case and investigating, and I was just amazed at what we came up with. Just how much evidence there was.
I miss Larry King. I miss seeing you on Larry King's show. Have we lost a lot of national exposure since he's gone? You know, we've got this show going, and you've got some internet-based programs. Well, what's going on in terms of media coverage?
Yeah, I know. That was a big boon. I mean, what it boiled down to, believe it or not, of course, Larry had a very keen interest in it, but there was a woman who was the executive producer of the show, and she had a son that was, I think, 11 or 12 years old, who was a huge fan of mine. And he just loved, he couldn't get enough of UFO-related material. I sent him autographed copies of all my work and stuff. And of course, when the Larry King show shut down, that access point. But, you know, I think that the level of interest kind of comes and goes with these things in mainstream media. I mean, look what happened recently with John Podesta. You know, that little tweet got a significant amount of media coverage.
Oh, yeah.
There were the Jimmy Kimmel interview with Obama. That was apparently played over and over in the taxis in New York. I'm talking now with Lee Spiegel at the Huffington Post.
Good guy, by the way. Great guy.
He's a great guy. Yeah, I really, really respect him a lot. very grounded. We're discussing, I have a letter that I got from Steven Spielberg, which people have talked about for quite some time, that I've never gone to the media and gone public with the actual letter itself.
Hold on for a second. Let's talk about that letter when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. James Fox with us, and we're going to take your calls, too, as we talk UFOs. James, tell me about this special letter.
Okay, so kind of tying in with this letter is that there's been a re-release of I Know What I Saw, and I put together some wonderful outtakes and stuff that never made it in the, you know, when you produce a film, the ratio to what ends up in the film to how much you shoot is like 50-1. So we had a bunch of additional material, and we're re-releasing I Know What I Saw, and this time I was doing it with a quote from Steven Spielberg, because I actually had the quote from late 2009. But against the publicist, Marvin Levy, for Steven Spielberg, and I'll get into the contents a little bit in just a minute.
Sure.
He asked me not kind of to hold off on it. So in any case, there's something really cool happening. It's being promoted and screened, I Know What I Saw, at the Sonoma Film Festival, which is happening this weekend. And it's absolutely free. From the generous sponsorship of a gentleman named Jim Ledwith, a.k.a. UFO Jim. So they've been tirelessly working to educate mainstream about the UFO phenomenon.
Our buddy Steve Bassett's going to be out there too, right?
Yeah, apparently Steve Bassett's going to be there. There's going to be Dr. Gordon Spear and Joe Buckman and obviously Jim Ledwith, myself, I'll be there. They're going to be screening Moon Rising, and which is done by Jose Escamilla.
Mm-hmm.
And then I Know What I Saw. And it's all absolutely, totally free. There's nothing for sale. We would just love if anyone's in the Northern California area and they'd love to come check out the old, beautiful district, downtown historic district plaza of Sonoma. That's where it will be, starting at 9 a.m. on the 28th. That's this Saturday. So I kind of wanted to mention that. And it's also being promoted with Steven Spielberg's quote.
Do you have the info on your website?
You know, if you go to UFOs, the letter R, real, UFOs, the letter R, real.com. It's got all the information about this weekend event. Really, really cool. So, and it's so rare that, you know, that someone actually steps up. You know, Jim's been quietly pushing for getting this stuff into mainstream for quite some time. He's a really...
Well, we need it. We have to get it out that way.
He's one of these guys who's putting his money where his mouth is, and he's been really making some wonderful progress on doing that. I mean, I remember trying to get my first UFO film into Sundance years ago, and they didn't even have a category for it. I mean, they kind of looked at me like, yeah.
Well, do you find, Jim, that nowadays people are more tuned into UFO stories and cases, or are they kind of like backing off them?
You know, I actually think that it's happening very slowly. I mean, you know, you get a few steps forward, you get a step backwards, a few steps forward, a step backwards. I mean, look at the resurgence of interest just recently. I mean, John Podesta, you know, he was top aide to President Obama. He's former chief of staff for President Clinton. He did that one tweet. I'm sure you know all about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we sure do.
That got a lot of attention. And, you know, Jimmy Kimmel is really interesting. From what I understand on his show, everything, all the questions are already sort of mapped out ahead of time. He asked President Clinton, if you look at the...
And President Obama.
Yeah, but if you look at what he did and what he said, it was exactly the exact same thing, almost like cut and paste. You know, talking about, oh, if I became president, and that'll never happen, you're kind of thinking, this is the things that I would do. And I've talked to Lee Spiegel about it just recently at the Huffington Post. He said that they've been taking that particular segment, which is only like 37 seconds long, extracting that out of the Kimmel Show with the interview with President Obama, which is a pretty long interview, and they were playing it over and over in podcasts all across New York. So there's a real interest for this subject matter, you know what I mean? We just need to get our foot in the door with someone like a Jimmy Kimmel or someone like, you know, we'll see what happens with, what's his name? He's about to go do his new night show. He had the Colbert Report.
Steve Colbert.
Yeah, exactly. Stephen Colbert, well, he's starting his new show, and I know that Leslie Kane has been on his show in the past, and who knows, maybe we'll get a foot in the door with someone like that, because people do recognize, and that was one of the things that I heard from Larry King, is that every time we did a UFO show, and that was unprecedented.
And he did many.
He did many.
He did many. We did. I did 9 alone with him, and he did more than that. And it would rate incredibly well, like really, really well, towards the top-rated shows. So there's a thirst for it out there. It's just a matter of getting our foot in the door with the right person, because as soon as they'll do one, I assure you, the ratings will do so well, and of course that's what they care about with television, that you know, we'll get more of it. So
let's take some calls. They're lining up here for you, James. Let's go to Hamilton, Ontario in Canada. Rosemary is with us. Rosemary, east of the Rockies. Hi there, Rosemary.
Hi. Good morning, George.
Hi.
Good morning, Jamie. How are you?
Hey, how you doing?
Great. I had two incidents of UFOs. Both of them happened between 35 and 40 years ago. When I was living in Burlington and looking towards Hamilton, where the large tower, I had seen an object doing a crazy eight several times. So I kind of figured a plane couldn't do it, a helicopter couldn't do it. That was the first one. And the second one was when me and my family were traveling to Florida. We were driving, and I was looking towards the horizon on my right side, and I could see something in the distance following us. And then all of a sudden, it just shot up a 90-degree angle, heading nowhere, like just straight up into space. So I knew that couldn't be a plane or a helicopter doing that either. So those are two of my experiences that with UFOs.
Well, and you're a believer now. Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, I am a believer. As soon as I saw that one with the crazy eight, I said there's no way an airplane or a helicopter could do that.
You know, I can't tell you the amount of times where I've had, you know, during my research where I've had people say, hey, you know, I don't want to go on camera, but let me just tell you what happened, you know, this kind of thing. And just recently, a couple of years ago, I was in Stephenville, Texas. I was shooting a little episode with one of my favorite all-time witnesses, which is Ricky Sorrells. He was the deer hunter. And I love these unambiguous cases where, you know, it could be nothing else than what they're describing. Either they're lying or this is what, you know, extremely unambiguous. And after the interview with Ricky Sorrells, I was standing in the downtown square, and this gentleman comes up to me in plain clothes, and he whips out a badge, and he opens it up, and he says, Mr. Fox, and he shows me, he says, I'm a police officer, blah, blah, blah. Can I have a word with you? I thought, oh, God, what did I do? But he pulls me aside, and he says, I just want you to know that you're on the right path, and Ricky Sorrells is dead honest guy. We all saw that object tonight. And not only that, the officer told me that it was low and slow. It was the size of a couple department stores is how big he described it. It was just suspended in the night sky, not that late. And he grabbed his radar gun and he pointed it up from the dashboard, and he got a bead on it doing 22 miles an hour. And he said that they got also some dash cam footage, and he said one of his biggest mistakes was not making copies of it, but that the local Air Force base confiscated that dash cam footage. And, of course, you know, they went and did what they did. But you hear these stories time and time again, people that don't go public, people like the woman who just called in, that are not trying to sell their story, that are not trying to go on camera and get, you know, famous or anything like this. And it really does keep you going.
Why aren't we getting the great landing stories of the past? We don't hear those anymore.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because when I was researching stuff, and I won't go into my sentiments on the show for National Geographic, but I will say that I was doing extensive research on landing cases, recent ones as well. And what I noticed was that every time I'd call to get access to some of the witnesses, they'd say, oh, yeah, was it NIDS by the gentleman, the billionaire?
Robert Bigelow.
Robert Bigelow, exactly. And they would say, oh, yeah, Bigelow's people came out here and took a lot of the evidence and photographs and that sort of thing. And I found that to be the case so many times that he was being very discreet, almost kind of like how the Air Force was being during their time. But that Bigelow was going in and he was taking a lot of the evidence and photographic evidence, whatever there was, on these land, having soil stamp analysis work done, according to the witnesses, and on many, many different cases. And I finally contacted Bigelow about it. I said, hey, what are you doing? You know, are you sharing this stuff with anybody? What are you going? He kind of just kind of laughed, you know. But so I think there are cases. I just don't think they're getting out there as much. Certainly they were back in 2011 and 12.
Let's go to Houston, Texas. Alex, you're on with James Fox on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, hello. Hi, Jordan. I've been a big fan for a long time.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm calling about a long time ago in Pasadena, which is a little city outside of Houston. I seen a black triangle UFO, and I was amazed by it. The next day, I researched it on the internet and everything, and you know, a lot of people seen them, and you always talk about it on your show. I've been a fan since then, like more than 10 years, and it just changed my life after seeing this. And now I've been doing the research, and I've seen that a lot of people tie it to the TR-3B. I want to see what y'all think about that.
How big was the craft?
It was bigger than my apartment, and it was real low with no sound to it. It was bigger than Walmart. So I live right behind Walmart. It was bigger than Walmart.
That's good. That's big.
Yeah, that is crazy. That's definitely big. I mean, some of these super Walmarts are colossal. Would you call it a super Walmart or just a regular Walmart?
I think it doesn't matter, James. They're big.
I was being somewhat facetious.
Have y'all heard about the TR-3Bs? I mean, I wonder what's the tie with that.
I've heard about those, but I think those are significantly, correct me if I'm wrong out there, you guys, but there was one that apparently had crash-landed in Fresno, I think, several years ago. There was some video footage of the recovery of it. But that seemed, according to eyewitness testimony, significantly smaller than a Walmart store.
Yes, we have nothing. We have nothing that big.
Yeah. Yeah, significantly smaller.
Alex, thanks for your question. Jim is in Orlando, Florida now. You're on Coast to Coast. Jim, go ahead.
Hey, guys. Great discussion. I actually have a pretty funny story.
Sure.
I was vacationing in Washington, D.C., and before I get to that, I'm a big guy. I do security, typically diplomatic security for a private company. So I'm a big guy. I look like a cop in the military, even though I've never been in one. But I was in Washington, D.C. on vacation, and I was on the metro rail, and these two people come into the train car that I was in, mom and son, probably 15, 16 years old, and they sit down. They looked funny, and as a security guard, I always, you know, just look. It's natural for me to gauge somebody when they come in. Well, they had like these yellow eyes, and I was sitting there thinking, well, I'm in Washington, D.C. It would surprise me if I run into an alien, and just by some weird chance, the kid, he gestures to his right, and I'm looking at his right. It's in the train car, so I don't really see anything, and then I realize his reflection actually changed. And he was one of the scaly reptilians. Like, he actually just had scales, and he winked at me in a reflection. And it was funny because his mom, because when I saw that, I shifted in my seat. I wasn't really scared, but I kind of freaked out a little bit, but I shifted. His mom noticed I shifted. She looked at me, and then looked at him, saw what he was doing. She smacked him on the back of the head real quick, and she looked at me, put her hand on her chest like she was embarrassed. She's like, oh, my God, I'm sorry. And then she came up to me and says, please don't report me to the agency. We're actually getting on the Underground Railroad, and we're leaving. We're heading back to Denver, and we're leaving. And it was funny. You know, they were nice. I thought I'd share that.
Great story.
Well, thanks for sharing that. You know, it's crazy. You know, Robert Bigelow had, you know, he's someone to be in a position to kind of know what's going on. He's had access. He's had that scientific organization that he's funded for a long time.
He's got a little floating hotel up there, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's doing that too. And he's, you know, he's a very, very successful businessman. He's grounded. He's intelligent. He's very well connected. If you look up Project Blue Book stuff, I think even today under Wikipedia, you'll see that Bigelow, they refer a lot of the sighting stuff to Bigelow now. But anyway, I had a meeting with him. We had lunch together. He's absolutely convinced that there are aliens walking among us. And I have to suspend judgment because I'm the kind of guy where, even though I do believe in UFOs, clearly, obviously, I'm working on my fourth film about it, I think extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. But, you know, I'm open to listening to reports like that. It's fascinating when you hear things.
Bigelow made his money. He owns the budget hotels chain.
Yes.
That's exactly
where
he made his money. Let's go next. Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, no, I was just saying that he's trying to get hotels in space, right?
That's right. Miles is in Buena Park, California now. Miles, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, George. Hello, James.
Hi.
Good evening, sir.
Great subject. Yep, great subject. And love to
come
hear always when James is on. And always love you, George.
Thank you.
When I was a kid, about 8 years old, some 40 years ago, I thought I had a dream, and me and two of my neighbors were sitting out in my front yard, and I thought that we saw three lights up in the sky hovering quite a distance away, you know, and there were no helicopters or airplanes, and we lived just south of the local little airport, and when the lights started moving around, we thought it was kind of strange, and then all of a sudden they started zipping back and forth and going further away and then coming back, and then they just jutted off into the sky and never again, and we didn't speak of it for another 30 years, about 20, 30 years, and my neighbor came up to me, and my older brother and I were talking about it, and he's teasing me, saying, "Oh, you're still talking about them UFOs." And my neighbor, one of them that was still living around, he was out there in the front yard. He came up to me and said, "That was no dream. We really had that happen to us."
Oh, fascinating.
Yep, and it was true. I mean, and everybody, and I always thought, and I've always believed in that type of thing, and even though I wasn't totally convinced that it was a true UFO at the time, but once he said that we were, you know, it really has happened, because we had been friends since we were 3 years old together, and he convinced me, you know, he says, "That was no dream, it really happened." That solidified it for me.
Hey, that's when your eyes pop out of your heads. James, what do you think of these abduction cases that are happening all over the place?
Well, I was just talking to Tracy Torme about that, actually, right before going on the radio with you. And Tracy wrote a book with Jacques Vallée. And by the way, I just listened to your interview with Jacques Vallée, and I was very envious because I bumped into Jacques Vallée a couple of months ago. And Tracy and I have been trying to get him to participate, even if it's off camera, with 701. And again, Tracy had written a book with Jack called Fast Walkers. And Jacques Vallée was just not interested at all. And I just said,
"No, his posture has changed a lot.
Totally changed, completely changed." And I said, is it you don't want to do it, or is it that you can't do it?" He said, "I can't do it." Almost like he'd made some kind of commitment or deal or something. I don't know. But it was very odd.
Yeah, that was a strange thing. You probably heard the George Knapp interview with him. I interviewed him a couple of years ago. So
I heard your interview with him.
That one.
Yeah, I was very envious that you got the opportunity to do that.
Back a long time.
Trying to get him.
I had him with Steve Bassett and a long time ago. He's one of a kind, but he's changed his posture. Look, we're out of time, James. The website, of course. Give us the website, James, very quickly for your event.
UFOs, the letter R, real. UFOsAreReal.com. Sonoma International Film Festival this weekend. It's all free on Saturday, the UFO panel. It's going to be very interesting, a couple of movies. Hope you guys can make it. Good wine, good food, good movies.
And good you, too. We'll be back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe with some great stories.